This evening we're finishing up the second chapter of Ecclesiastes. I guess next week Ron has the floor. So we'll get into chapter 3 in 2 weeks. Before we get into this lesson, though, just a quick reminder of the evangelism project after services. We'll make it quick. I just got to find out who's interested in going another month and, you know, what your needs are. So I'm coming and do that fairly quickly. As for tonight's lesson, if you want to, you turn in your Bibles to Ecclesiastes, the second chapter, and we'll be beginning around verse 18. Oh, previously the author of Ecclesiastes had turned to consider wisdom and the madness and the folly as the other end of the spectrum, getting the full breadth of what he was trying to do, and trying to examine them in the fullest, pitting one against the other in order to determine how to experience life to the fullest. He did discover what made life enjoyable concerning various pleasures, for why else do men turn to these things? Yet, in the final analysis, even what people do find, again, this is under the sun, under that expression of just looking at life, you know, what's the meaning of it without God? But he found out these things, too, were transient and fell far short of satisfaction. If you're tired of this under the sun thing, we're going to get out of it by the third chapter. So this is kind of like the last, you know, big thing, anyway, he's going into. He now reflects on one aspect of this, that of what might be considered a labor of love, which a lot of people get into. There's things that people do like to do, and they pour their whole life into them. In fact, hardly ever retire, you know, from it until the very end. Which to be sure offers some reward, yet the final outcome leaves him a bit distraught, you know, as he considers one aspect of this. Verse 18 says, "Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me." Okay, and that's the basic thing what we're looking at. Here's all this work you put into something, and then what happens? There are reasons for regarding one's work as one of the finest blessings of life, but one's daily work comes under the condemnation of being vanity. If such work confines itself to earthly pursuits and ambitions, it leaves out consideration of spiritual and heavenly values. Koheleth, then, the preacher, begins this verse with one of his favorite repetitions, "I hated all the fruit of my labor." But the author reflects not on work as such, but on a factor that is often to be met with in connection with work, and that is the question, what will the man who comes after me and takes over my work do with the things I've labored so hard to achieve? This is why they generally have sons that kind of take over and are very disappointed when, you know, Junior, instead of wanting to take over the business, decides to live a life of an artist and go play guitar all the time. In Solomon's case, he may have had some justified misgivings about his son Rehoboam, so there may be a little historical, you know, thing to this. But verse 19 says, "Who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun." This too is vanity. So one never has a guarantee whether one's successor will be a wise person or a fool. And you can even get gradients of this. Perhaps, you know, the one that takes over perhaps doesn't quite have the genius, you know, to take it where, yeah, what comes to mind almost immediately is, you know, Disneyland. I mean, he was the genius behind it, everything. You know, nothing got built, nothing got finished unless he okayed it. I know, my dad worked for him for a little bit. and then when he died, they just didn't seem that, you know, quality of genius and perspective that they had while he was alive. Time will tell, but there is a magnitude of the problem. He will have control over all that you've worked for. My mind's going different directions. I just thought of an old joke somebody told. Sitting around a graveyard site, they're looking down the guy in the coffin, and somebody asked, "How much did he leave?" And someone said, "He left everything." Yeah, you're not going to take anything with you. Yeah, so maybe you ought to start storing treasures in heaven. Yeah. Have full control is an apt expression and conveys the worry that after the conscious new worker, there became a thoroughly shiftless man. I think we covered this. One historical example of this is found in the Roman times after Augustus and Tiberius labored for decades to fill the Roman coffers with enough money so they could have a standing army and keep their, you know, government going. Along comes Caligula and spent it all in 1 year with riotous living. Okay, 20. Therefore, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. Not forgetting that in verse 18, we're still contemplating this under the sun thing. Without God, the author says, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor. Okay, if there's nothing in the labor, okay, this is, you know, what we're pushing, a consideration of whatever you're doing, whether it's raising a family or the job you've picked or the career or whatever, are you working for God? Is there some sort of higher value involved in it? If not, it will be terminated with your death. Literally, Hebrews says, I turned about to cause my heart to despair. It's something you brought on yourself. Okay. To make the point unmistakably clear, we add that such a conclusion can never be reached in the case of a man who is committed to toiling for higher values, okay, such as God's word and Christ's gospel. And this is what God tells us. You know, New Testament, Jesus said, you put my kingdom first, and I'll take care of everything else. However, God does know that such work is not without its disappointments, even the higher stuff, as Paul describes 2 Corinthians 11:28. You know, there he talks about that list of all the things he's had to endure in the near death. And then he goes at the very last of it, he goes, and there's the daily concern for all the churches. So even as you're building this thing, you laid a foundation and you're building worthwhile as Paul did, there's still, you know, the sorrow of losing those that have come in and then are going back out again. And Galatians 1:6, where he goes, man, I'm amazed you're so quickly deserting the gospel I preached to you. Okay, so when there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and great evil. Koheleth would yet make plain that he says by indicating that he has not conducted his experiment on a trivial level. He is not thinking of a man who has no heart for his work, but rather one who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. The full impact of the terms would be constructive wisdom, comprehensive knowledge, and skillful workmanship. This guy knew what he was doing. He put together something that was phenomenal. And then you go, so what? One might expect such toil to be reason for a hopeful outlook, but only too often his legacy is given to one who has not labored with such resourcefulness. For what does a man get in all of his labor and in his strivings with which he labors under the sun? If one looks to the future and one does well to think in terms of achieving something lasting and worthwhile in the future, what does he really get when he labors under the sun? If he sees one's work disintegrating under the hand of incompetent persons who will follow after, it is enough for one to say, what is the use? We've got examples of this in modern society, where people put together something that's really great, and then like a company, and they sell out, but they see that the people that are running it now are just incompetent idiots. And they're so concerned about their little baby that they'll actually take all their life savings and buy the company back in order to rescue it. I think that's what happened with Steve Jobs and Macintosh, Apple. You know, he just didn't like the way they were running it, so he came out of retirement and we got back into it. Because all of his days, his task is painful and grievous. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is vanity. When one takes the time to dwell on this and to be sure, the preacher is writing this to get people to take the time to consider their life and the meaning of it, where it's heading, what is to follow, so that his days will, you know, hopefully not be painful and grievous. You know, it is painful and grievous if you're not considering this. I mean, just look at yourself now. Where are you going? Where are you going? Especially for the young people, you know, what's your plans? You think you got all this life ahead of you to decide and whatever, but not always. Not always. And you've got to be prepared for whatever your goals are to make some U-turn. We're going to see that in the next chapter. I mean, there's a lot of guys I know during, you know, just before World War II, that all these plans of family and education and everything else and good careers got cut short. Everybody had to go to war. There's going to be times like that. You know, when such instances are just going to cut into whatever plans you've got. Was the old expression, if you want to hear God laugh, tell him your plans. Further, even at night, the mind continues to worry over problems and hopefully reflect on what needs to be done. However, when the mind does not conclude that God needs to be part of it all, you're back into the vanity. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I've seen, that it is from the hand of God. Now, however you read this thing in the past, you know, we're going to put a little bit of spin on it because it's probably not what you're thinking. You know, sometimes the translators, I mean, it's acceptable translation, but it may not be really to the point of the context of what's going on here. Koheleth has thus far been demonstrating the vanity of things by the most direct method. He has given a practical demonstration by showing what the seemingly most enjoyable things really amount to when they are put in a practical and exhaustive test. He now, though, follows with something that is akin to deductive method. Some general principles are stated not by way of giving conclusions that are drawn from previous data, but by way of showing that the same conclusions have to be drawn from certain commonly accepted general principles. This is where parables come from, laying one truth alongside of another. Okay, and the ecclesiastical writer is going to do this. He's actually going to start moving into spiritual things to look at them and say, okay, it's also in, you know, the common realm also. For the first time, he reaches beyond the level of the things under the sun, leaving the strict division between that and the higher spiritual values found in things above where one finds the source of true joy. So he's going to start creeping back and forth between this line and this drawn. The case is first stated negatively. The ability to enjoy or enable him to have true enjoyment does not lie in man. Stop to think about that. Can you make yourself be happy all the time? I mean, even the root of the word happiness is the word hap, you know, which has to do with happenstance. It comes and it goes, and sometimes there's nothing you can do about it. The translation, there is nothing better, does not express the literal Hebrew of it is not a good thing in man. Okay. If taken that the preacher is saying that it is not inherent in man on his own to enjoy these things, but rather it is God's gift, then it goes along with the remaining two verses. The thought of the passage is that true enjoyment is possible, but it does not lie within man's power to bestow it on himself. Man is not the fountain of good. Such good is for the present defined as eating and drinking and getting satisfaction. Now, this is not riotous living. This is, you know, the things that God has given us to sustain us, the food, the drink, whatever, and being satisfied with our labor. Where does that satisfaction come from? Where does the enjoyment of that stuff? Even as he was looking about going through these things to make the most of it, you know, now he starts to think about where exactly does that satisfaction come from? Where exactly, you know, why do I like this? You know, why is it when you walk out and you watch the sunset that you don't get violently ill and start vomiting? Where does this aesthetic quality come from? For who can eat and who can enjoy without him? And the choice of good things mentioned is motivated by the preceding thoughts that had dealt with the problem of enjoying good in the things of earth. One may take this passage to mean, even things on this low level cannot be enjoyed unless God so grants. So we know that if a person is dedicating to himself to God, there's enjoyment in what he's doing. You know, he's got that. It's a given. But now he's saying, okay, as you're looking at where even does your satisfaction come through on under the sun things without God in it, God's still looking after you. God's still giving you this part, mostly as a sample to say, if you like this, then here's how to get real true satisfaction. Okay. Let me put it another way. I like cookies. I like the texture. They don't even have to taste good. I just like the texture, whatever. You know, you want me to kill somebody, just offer me a cookie. Okay. I've come to realize, where does the satisfaction of the cookies come from? Okay. They're from God. He's given me the ability, the taste and everything else, and the warm feeling in my stomach and whatever. You know, as long as I'm doing it in moderation and I'm doing it as long as, you know, especially if I'm studying or whatever like that, it sustains me and everything's fine. But if I start to keep it at a lower level and just go, more cookies. You know, and I empty that tub of cookies. You know, there's no satisfaction anymore. Okay? Yeah, you know, I'm sick to my stomach and you know, I can't look at even food anymore. Because I've kept it at a lower level. That's a hyperbole. I'm really not that sick about cookies. Okay. Did I read this one? Even things on this low level cannot be enjoyed unless God so grants. God only can make a man realize that food and drink are divine gifts. Isn't that Paul's argument to those at Lystra? You know, it's like, He's given us seasons, he's given us rains, you know, and the fruit and everything else. Just a reminder that he's there. Where does all spiritual blessings come from? Where does all blessings come from? All good things, all goods, all gifts from God. Right? For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. While to the sinner he is given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after a wind. Okay, there's another little spin that's coming up. To round out this part of the thought, it is essential that there be some indication as to the basis on which God does allot enjoyment and when it pleases him to do so. So we're looking at, in this last verse, we see that God's gifts are very often conditioned on man's attitude. The good here, contrast with sinners, are the ones God grants wisdom and knowledge. Okay, so if you're really trying to serve God in what Koheleth was looking for, you know, knowledge, good knowledge, wisdom, you know, the gaining of things, where does it become satisfying? Where does it become rewarding? What it has to do with the things collected concerning God. And put it another way, in the New Testament, a lot of parallels. I think it's Paul that says, writing to Timothy, a lot of people, you know, there are those that are ever learning, but never coming to a knowledge of the truth. Why? Because they haven't got God in consideration. All their venturing takes them around the wrong paths. Since joy is appended to these terms, it is understood that they are different from worldly wisdom and knowledge that are vanity. This wisdom and knowledge brings joy. To the sinner, God gives vexation. Kote in participle form expressing continuous action. They're constantly vexed. It's disturbed, frustrated, you know, they can't tell, you know, no joy because it's not in them to get it. And they've gone down wrong avenues. So he gives them vexation in gathering and in heaping up things. I mean, in John, it says, you know, it's just the amount of books that are out there are endless. Can't read them all. Can't read them all. And just, you know, a variety of subjects and everything. And it's just, it's tiresome. Just can't keep up with all of it. But how much is really worth anything? Think back at all that science you learned, and it's constantly being debriefed, debugged, whatever. Can you imagine, you know, learning all there was about science in the first century? Okay. A funny thing happened on the way to the forum. There's, you know, a young man's being instructed by his teacher, and he goes, you know, we know there's only five planets and that the sun revolves around the earth. You know, that's your science. And they think, oh, man, this is, you know, great. Yeah, but how wrong was it and how useless was it? In fact, even now, even if you understood Einsteinian physics, When was the last time you built a linear accelerator in order to put it all to use? When was the last time did they have Atom Smashers, home version, that you can use? It's impressive. I mean, you can buy Scientific America, and I used to do this and read through all this stuff, but man, it's like you wait 2 years and then somebody comes out with another article and says, well, the former stuff we just gave to you is all garbage. I used that in a class one time because it was a 1970 issue that talked about plate tectonics, the shifting of the continents and the moving them around and floating. And like 3 years later, somebody goes out, oh, we re-examine the evidence and go, hey, the continents don't really move that much. And it was kind of cute because I was teaching that in Sunday school class to the high school students about the new science. And my daughter was in science class, and they just gotten a lecture from a guest speaker on plate tectonics. And she went up the front to see which, her source of material was, and it was the old version of, Scientific American. We try to keep you updated here in church, folks. Try to keep you updated. Right. Oh, okay, so, further, God disposes of what the wicked gather in such a way that they themselves may be said to give it to him whom the Lord pleases to have it given. Okay. This is one of the reasons why you don't have to envy the rich. Okay? J. Paul Getty, J.P. Morgan, George Soros, all these guys that are becoming billionaires and destroying economies in order to accumulate all the toys in the world. God says, in the final analysis, it's all going to go to the ones that serve me anyway. Think about it. These guys are working for you. Don't begrudge the rich too much. In fact, even on a practical level, I learned this a long time ago. You really don't want to take the money away from the rich because they like to build things. And if they like to build things, as long as they like to build things, they like to hire you to build them. Okay, and they share their money with you. Okay, it's a better way of doing it. So this is all, striving after win. Don't worry about it. Don't get your mind on you collecting the toys like everybody. This is what Coelho is trying to say. Even in troublesome times, we came into this, is as you look at what's going on around you, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter if your neighbor has a big house, 3 stories and 2 cars, and you've got like a 1-story flat with a bicycle. Eventually, it's all going to come to you anyway. Okay, so probably a better way of looking at it, but just he's trying to say don't envy the rich. Don't strive to be keeping up with the Joneses. There's more important things out there, and if you latch onto that as life, then you're going to have constant joy. And Jesus promises his disciples, your joy no man can take from you. Okay, we're done with this. Closing. On this theme, again, Ecclesiastes is written for not just the common man. It's a good place to start if you're trying to convert people out of the world to let them know which way their life is going. But also it's good for, as we begin in chapter 3, for God's people, what he considers his church. It's a consideration. And with this, I got a few moments just to get you to think about, extended an invitation this morning if you want to become a Christian. That still holds. But for those that are God's people, consider God's people. A lot of this stuff, of the same kind of things that people under the sun get involved in, you can do the same thing with God's kingdom. In fact, the task is upon us, not only personally, to look at our lives to say, as we're laboring, what can we leave? And put it on a personal level first here. As you're building a family, I mean, if you've taken the time to really study and become a good Christian, you look to see if you know to marry a good Christian, you know, spouse, whatever, so you can serve God better, and you're looking to have children. Have you really made the plans to raise those children so that your tribe or dynasty or whatever, as it moves on through the ages and generations, will not only preserve the spiritual faith that you got, but will even increase it? Are you making those kind of plans, and are you laboring toward that end? Or as you're looking at the church, one of the scary things is we go through the scriptures. All the churches we read about, Ephesus, Smyrna, Philippi, Corinth, they're all gone. Okay. First century, the men labored with genius. Christ, Paul, others, I mean, Luke, you know, they were inspired, but they also were fit tools for the things that had to be done. And Paul tells Timothy to entrust what you've learned to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. We have to look to the future to see, you know, where the church is going. I mean, just look at our location. Are we concentrating to make this the best possible, strong, spiritual church that even after we're gone, whether we move or we die off, our posterity will be preserved and perhaps even be more spiritual and stronger than we ever were? Or are we just laboring to the wind? We're just coming, we're sitting, and not really planning on how to build upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets. You may be saved, but Paul warns us in 1 Corinthians, all your work may be destroyed. It behooves us to get serious about what we're doing, to get smart about what we're doing. You know, to put a lot of prayer into it and borrow upon God's wisdom and genius to make sure that those that come after us are even a better situation than we are. It could come in a lot of different ways. Just one example, and the lesson will be yours. As you look at your Bible, and there's a lot of people that say it's been, you know, chopped up and it's no longer, you know, the way it was in the first century and everything. First of all, that's the big lie that's being spread. If you look at the experts, you know, whether it's Finnegan or Dr. Kenyon out of the British Museum or some of the others, A.B. Robertson, you know, Bishop, they talk about the scriptures. These are the guys that study these things. Or Westcott and Hort, you know, the people that put together the science of textual criticism. They say we've got the scriptures, every last part of it, down to the last period by the apostles. We haven't lost anything. But you got to ask yourself, why? Spirit was doing his work, but people had to be doing their work too. How are the scriptures preserved? I mean, the three oldest Bibles, they were found because someone hid one in a convent, you know, in the middle of Mount Sinai. That was the Sinaitic manuscript. The Vatican, they found buried in the tombs of the Vatican. The Alexandria, I'm not quite sure where they found it. But basically, it wasn't sitting out there preserved for everybody to read. You know, it was in archives. You know, they were buried away among other manuscripts. But they were preserved. God made sure that his word was preserved by all the copies that were made of it, more than any other books in history. But who made the copies? Who had such an interest in the scriptures in order to preserve it flawlessly? Okay. And if that wasn't enough, all the people that defended Christianity in the first 3 years, and in their writings, you know, some have said we could almost reconstruct the New Testament, or all the translations that were made, people that found something so precious that they took it, you know, to their own countries and translated into their own languages. We have all those too. In fact, they had such a regard for the scriptures, learning Russian, it's a Syriac script. Cyric means it was put together by the monk Cyrus, who, among the Slavic people, trying to teach them the scriptures, but they didn't have a written language. So he took the Greek letters, and this is what Russian is mostly made up of, is Greek letters, the Greek alphabet. And he gave the Slavic people a written language so they could copy down the scriptures and preserve it. People were making plans to make sure that God's salvation was preserved for the souls in the future. There's all sorts of ways that we can start thinking about, you know, even if we're kind of in a, you know, paddling against the current, we can still leave things so that when the course of history changes, people will find the things that we've left and be benefited by them. Whether it's our websites or our writings or, you know, whatever we've done, you know, the libraries we bury someplace so that they can have all the advantages we have and more. And all the work that people do, it's like, it's incredible the amount of reference material that's out there. Concordances, dictionaries, lexicons, commentaries of people that have labored in order to give us the tools that we can do a Bible study on our own, even from the original languages. Think about it. You know, how you want to build on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. And if there's anything we can do to help each other, let us know. The invitation is yours as we stand to sing.